Sairam, dear listeners, it's Musings Time with Professor G. Venkatraman. Today we bring you a Musings Talk on the topic, Education and Learning. And here it is for your listening pleasure.
Loving Sairam and greetings from Prashanthi Nilayam. As many of you must be aware, in the early days of Radio Sai, I used to do a regular program called Musings. This title enabled me to wander over a wide range of topics that were not only important, but also current. Many seemed to like this series, since it connected Swami's teachings with aspects of daily life and the world as it is today. A couple of years ago, this regular routine of mine got sharply interrupted by a series of urgent priorities that came piling one upon another. The circumstances were such that I just could not duck those jobs, which had to be dealt with right then and not postponed. Furthermore, the nature of these jobs was such that I could not pass the buck. I therefore accepted what was happening as a part of the grand and inscrutable design of the divine, which is how I became almost cut off from the musings pipeline. As the 90th birthday approaches, and as Radio Sai is furiously trying to reorganize itself to assume higher responsibilities, many new tasks are coming up. Be that as it may, I would like to get back to my old routine, especially as it allows me to be in touch with you. That contact, by the way, is vital for us, since without your feedback, we could be just broadcasting to empty space. As I often say, when one is speaking to an audience, one knows when people get up and leave. But with a radio audience, you would never know if the listener has shut off the receiver and walked away. That is one of the main reasons why feedback is important, which is also why we keep on reminding you to write back. As I was saying, despite newer and heavier chores to do, I have resolved to renew my regular contact with you. And to ensure that I do not quickly lose you, I have chosen a topic that is so important that I simply cannot afford to run away from it. And that topic happens to be education. Possibly, many of you are probably yawning and saying, after all that build-up, did this guy have to choose such a dry topic, which, by the way, has already been thrashed to death? Could he not come up with something better, especially since there are so many nice topics to choose from? I would not at all be surprised if you thought like that. In fact, if I were at the listening end, maybe I would be saying similar things, quite possibly in a more colorful manner. But here's my take, and please bear with me for a moment. Suppose for a moment you replace the word education with learning. After all, education is all about learning something or the other, is it not? If we focus on learning, we would quickly realize that we begin this learning process almost as soon as we come into the world, take the first breath and open our eyes. And in some manner or the other, this learning process goes on right till the end. By the way, studies have shown that the rate of learning in babies is far higher than in adults. To many of you, my last remark might seem far-fetched, and so let me give a simple example. Suppose an anthropologist with a PhD from, say, Yale or Cambridge or whatever, goes deep into the jungles of Borneo and comes into contact with one of the many tribes there. For your information, Borneo is the fourth largest island on Earth. It has some of the most pristine rainforests and is shared by three countries, Brunei, Indonesia, and Malaysia. The aborigines in this island speak many different dialects that are not known even to the officials of the countries of which the various regions of Borneo are a part. Thus, when our anthropologist wanders in the jungle and comes upon one of these ancient tribes, he would not be able to find a single translator who can help him to have a conversation with the native tribes. Perhaps you are wondering again and asking yourself, what has Borneo and its aboriginal tribes got to do with learning? Well, hold on and I'll be there in a moment. Let's go back to where we were. There is this PhD with many papers and perhaps a few books also to his credit. His explorations have brought him in contact with a tribal group deep in the jungles of Borneo. He wants to talk to these people, but no translator is available. And then his eyes fall upon a toddler who is following his mom and chatting away, while the mother is cleaning corn maybe and is talking to a child. The question is, how come a child is able to speak a language which grown-up governing officials are not able to? I'm sure you have reached the edge of your patience. This time, you are probably screaming. Listen, this is what every child does. It learns its language from its mother, and that is why the native language is always referred to as the mother tongue. Aren't you aware of that? Let me assure you that I am well aware of that, and it is precisely that fact that makes me pose the question. Please give me a minute to explain. My point is the following. When an adult wants to learn a foreign language formally, that person has to attend classes and go through a long drill. In my undergraduate class, I opted for French, and at the end of 2 years, I could sort of understand simple sentences if written. Where spoken French was concerned, that language with its subtle accents is so difficult I could not understand a word. Later, when I went to Paris, I realized how limited my knowledge of French was. After college, when I studied engineering briefly, I had to learn German. Once again, it was tough. Sorry to bother you with petty details of my life, but I do need to make a point. Let me jump the years and come to my retirement, after which I came here to Prashanthi Nilayam. Here, survival meant that I pick up at least conversational Telugu. That I have managed, thanks to the kindness of many, especially our beloved Bhagwan, who was supremely patient and tolerant of my most atrocious violations of all rules of Telugu grammar. And after over 2 decades, I can sort of get by and also catch a fair bit of every discourse. At this stage, allow me please to make a plug for Radio Sai by saying that we have an entire stream devoted to Bhagwan's discourses that goes on 24/7, and this stream broadcasts nothing but discourses. The commercial over, let me get back to learning languages. What I have managed over 2 decades, every single child does in about 2 years. In fact, it does much better. This happens all over the world. If you think about this, you would appreciate how remarkable is the learning ability of a child is. Studies have shown that this rate of learning is incredibly high. Further, as the child grows, its rate of learning comes down. Some may counter this with the argument that some students pick up maths and various other subjects in school with astonishing ability. Yes, exceptions do exist, and many learn faster than others. I grant that. However, their percentage is small. In the case of babies, almost all of them, except those with disabilities, all babies learn very fast and without regular lessons. That is the important point. Most of you are probably saying, okay, you are just repeating a well-known fact. Nature has designed things to be that way. What's the big deal? I entirely agree that baby's endowment comes entirely from Mother Nature's compassion. But I have a question. If babies can learn pretty fast, why can't we? I'm sure many would be offended by that remark. Perhaps a listener is right now trying to counter by saying, listen, I got my PhD in biochemistry 50 years ago. Back then, there was no subject called molecular biology. Today, I am one of the leading experts in that subject. All the learning needed to become such an expert was done after I got my PhD. So what do you mean by saying adults can't learn? I would say your talk shows you can't learn. Well, that's a nice try. You know, when I came here after retirement, I had to teach two subjects, semiconductor lasers and digital image processing. Both these subjects simply did not exist when I got my PhD decades ago. In other words, I too had to learn new subjects while growing in my profession. If that be the case, what is the big point I am trying to make? Well, it's time to come to that. Sometimes, you know, it helps to irritate the audience a bit so that they become belligerent. But in the process, they also listen carefully because they want to shoot down the next argument. And that is why I decided to set myself up so that I would, borrowing from Mark Antony, have your ears. Now, here's my question. If you are all that smart and can learn so many things so quickly, how come we are not able to learn the nuances of Swami's teachings? I know a whole lot of you would bristle at what I am saying, but please be patient and bear with me for a couple of minutes to make my point. When the Lord incarnated as Sri Krishna, He gave only one discourse, and that discourse was given to one man, Arjuna. And that discourse was delivered on the battlefield minutes before a long war was about to begin. As Swami has told us, three people heard that discourse. Not one, but three. The first, of course, was Arjuna, to whom the discourse was addressed. The second was Sanjaya, the companion of the blind king Dhritarashtra. Sanjaya was specially given this blessing so that he could give a running commentary of the battle fought in Kurukshetra. The third person who heard the discourse was sage Vyasa, who recorded it, with of course the help of Lord Ganesha. This discourse, given by Krishna, better known as the Bhagavad Gita, consists of 700 slokas or hymns, and it contains the quintessence of Vedantic philosophy, with a special sweetener, which is that the Lord not only identifies Himself as the Atma as well as Brahman, but also reveals His cosmic aspect. Okay, that was 5,000 years ago, and let us now cut to the Kali age. The Lord comes again as a Purna Avatar, exactly like Krishna, and like Krishna, not only lives His message, but also gives discourses on the subject. The only difference between the Krishna Avatar and the Sri Satya Sai Avatar is that our beloved Swami delivered about 1,000 discourses. Maybe it's more, because nobody has a full count of all the discourses He delivered. And if you examine carefully, you would find that Swami unpacked the Gita and repackaged it into 1,000 discourses addressed to a variety of audiences, ranging from school children and villagers on one side, all the way to students, teachers, Vedic scholars, doctors, engineers, businessmen, tycoons, and whatnot. In this manner, Swami has explained in great detail many things, all of which Krishna too touched upon, but only very briefly. Thus, Swami's discourses have in them the lessons and guidance for all occasions and circumstances. To put it differently, every single problem human society faces today, most of which seem impossibly complex and beyond solution, every one of these problems can be solved if only one takes the trouble to find out what Swami has said and follow what He has said. Many years ago, speaking about the problems America was then facing, President Bill Clinton said, "There is nothing wrong with America which cannot be solved with what is right about America." I would take it one step further and say, there is no problem faced by human society that cannot be solved by the diligent application of Swami's teachings. However, this fact is little appreciated, and through these musings, I wish to create some awareness of how problems arise, where we go wrong in trying to solve them, and finally, how these problems must actually be solved. As I go along, you would not only realize how clearly Swami has said it all, but also with detailed explanations and examples. Before I get down to what Swami has said, I must mention some facts which, though well known, are often lost sight of. The result is that a widespread feeling has developed in this land of Ramakrishna and Swami, that spirituality is all about seeking personal comfort, mental peace and possibly salvation, but has nothing to do with society's problems. Some stretch this further to argue that spirituality is a figment of imagination, while others go even further to assert that spirituality is a fraud and a convenient way of making money. Somehow the feeling has grown that all these thousands of years, the religious hierarchy in India was taking everyone for a ride and making suckers out of them. Agreed that the ancient religious system did suffer from atrophy, as a result of which some aberrations did creep in. However, the basic fact is that any organizational system can atrophy if it does not adapt itself to changing times without compromising on the basic principles. When I say any organizational system, I do mean any system. It could be an administrative system, an economic system, a political system, and of course also a religious system. By the way, even the body and the mind of an individual can degenerate if it is not taken care of properly. Let me explain myself. These days it has become a fashion amongst many of the young intellectuals in India to trash the Bhagavad Gita without reading it, of course. Their fundamental complaint? Krishna is guilty of imposing and sanctifying the notorious and most obnoxious caste system, whose effects are still to be seen in India, although the caste system itself is supposed to have been declared illegal, etc. This particular case and others like it need to be studied carefully to appreciate how atrophy can and does enter if one is not careful. Now, this complaint about the caste system goes back to Krishna telling Arjuna that people have different aptitudes. That is really what the so-called Varna system means. What Krishna was telling Arjuna was that diversity was a signature of nature, and such diversity occurs also in humans in respect of aptitudes, abilities and so on. Nothing more and nothing less. Moreover, back in those days, the people followed hereditary practices. Thus, it was natural for a farmer's son to take to farming, a hunter's son to become a hunter when he grew up, a carpenter's son to take over his father's trade and business when the time came, and so on. In fact, this is what happened the world over. And if you do not believe me, just look at some of the English family names like carpenter, ironmonger, goldsmith, and so on. In India too, it started off like that. But then, as happens often, atrophy set in. That was when domination by the community that had access to knowledge and property also set in. And the birth of the notorious caste system was the direct result of such atrophy. One man who fought the caste system tooth and nail was none other than Mahatma Gandhi. Few remember that it was his effort that led to the passage of what I think was called the Temple Entry Act that allowed people of all castes to enter temples and worship them. It is illuminating to know how Gandhiji described the caste system, and I quote, "Untouchability is not a sanction of religion. It is a device of Satan. The devil has always quoted the scriptures, but scriptures cannot transcend reason and truth," unquote. Gandhi adds, quote, "God did not create men with the badge of superiority or inferiority. No scripture which labels a human being as inferior or untouchable because of his birth can command our allegiance. It is a denial of God and truth," unquote. Let us pause and reflect on these words, as also what meaning they have for aberrations that have occurred elsewhere and indeed have survived to this day in various shades. Having done that, we also need to ask, what is it that drives even so-called highly educated people to engage in class, racial and religious discrimination? Those questions are seldom asked, but Swami touched upon them times without number. And the point of these musings is, how come we kept missing all those gems? But that comes a little later, and let me go back to how system atrophy and system degeneration occur. In saying this, let me emphatically state that I am not defending the caste system, for that is how my arguments are likely to be labeled. In fact, as a small boy, I well remember living through this revolt against Brahminical tyranny in India. Now, if you look carefully at history, you would find that atrophy sets in when one class or community or group of people manage to get into a position of power and privilege and do not want to lose it. Once a privileged group develops that feeling of possession, it soon converts it into some kind of an entitlement and thereafter invents arguments to justify its wrong actions. In addition, it starts using power and muscle to impose its will. Such domination has occurred in the field of religion, socio-economics, politics, business and so on. In all cases, it's the feeling of threat felt by a privileged group through its status, privilege, wealth, power, etc., and which it does not want to lose or be taken away, that leads to discrimination and domination. Let us start with religion. We have the famous case of Galileo being ill-treated by the Catholic Church. What was Galileo's crime? He said, it is not the earth which is at the center of the solar system, but the sun. Many such examples can be drawn from history. Please note, I am not trying to run down the Catholic Church, nor have I forgotten the Jesuits and their great commitment to sacrifice and service. All I am trying to say is that any system can slide into atrophy if it is not careful. Take Islam next. These days we are asked to associate Islam with terrorism. But not many are aware of a brand of Islam known as Sufism, which is most tolerant and many of whose principles are quite similar to that of Hindus as well as Christians. In India, we have in Ajmer the resting place of the Sufi saint Khwaja Moinuddin Chisti, which is visited by both Muslims and Hindus. In fact, a play on this Muslim saint has been staged in Swami's presence many years ago. And yet, there are ultra-fundamentalists who say that anyone who does not worship Allah in a particular manner is an infidel and must be eliminated. Now, many years ago, I had a BBC program on religion in which an imam living in Britain was asked a question concerning Islamic fundamentalism. His remark, and I heard this repeated many times by many other Islamic scholars, the remark of the Imam speaking on BBC was that the enemies of Allah exist in the minds of humans. It is those enemies who are to be eliminated and not the children of God. The Imam then went on to categorically assert that Islam does not sanction killing of other human beings on any ground. Instead, it wants the faithful to cleanse their minds. If you think about it, you would recall how many times Swami asked us to clean out our minds and get rid of kama, krodha, moha, lobha, mada and matsarya. In various ways, the teachings of Jesus also echo the same. The question now arises, how come all religions have the same core message of compassion, love, sacrifice and helping those in distress? The answer is simple. All religions have the same core message because all religions are centered around God, who is love, who is compassion, etc. And that fact was dinned into us by Swami again and again. In fact, there is hardly a discourse that does not contain the message of universality in some form or the other. Just to continue with how the blindness of prejudice can come to anyone, anywhere and in horrible forms, let us recall that when slaves were imported into North America, they were considered as property. And then came a problem. When independence was won and the Bill of Rights was drafted, the founding fathers wondered how to keep slaves, in spite of the emphatic declaration that all men are created equal. The way out was to work in some obscure bylaws that declared black people to be only 60% human. Thus, they could be owned just as one owned horses, cows, cattle, pigs, and chicken. So you see, the mind is very clever in deluding itself. Much later, after the civil war which led to all slaves being freed, racial discrimination was reintroduced by the back door to enforce segregation. This was a kind of domination that circumvented some of the regulations imposed by the abolition of slavery. The idea was to suppress black people in some form or the other so that the privileges of racial superiority could be protected. Let me assure you once again that I am not trying to tarnish any one community or religious or racial group. On the other hand, my object is to draw attention to how all of us are equally vulnerable to committing the same mistake by taking refuge in false dogma. I shall come to it in a minute, but meanwhile, let me point out that in the peak of the Jim Crow era, as segregation in America was known, just as it was known as apartheid in South Africa, many churches where African Americans used to worship were actually bombed. One can ask, would Christ sanction that? Obviously, Christ never sanctioned such monstrosities, but people can stretch any law or religion to claim authority and sanction to engage in acts that basically hurt others. The ultimate irony is the way mosques are being blown up in Iraq. Sometimes it's the mosque of Shias, while on the other occasions it's the mosque of Sunnis. Now, many of you may complain that I am talking about negative things and that it is necessary to talk positive. I agree we must talk about positive things. But you know how our amazing Dr. Narasimhan has done an unbelievable miracle with Swami's mobile hospital, works to take his message, tirelessly explains how we ruin our body via bad habits like drinking, smoking, chewing tobacco, etc. And after doing that, he explains how to prevent such problems from occurring. There's a lot of merit in the strategy. Now, many years ago, I met a German scientist in Calcutta, which is now called Kolkata. This German scientist told me he used to be a chain smoker and was told repeatedly by his doctor friend to give up smoking. But this scientist paid little heed. One day, the doctor told his friend, "Tomorrow, I am going to do an interesting surgery. I think you should be present. I am sure you would be amazed by the things we doctors can do." So the scientist agreed and went into the operation theater after cleaning himself up, wearing sterile gown, etc. The surgeon was removing a lung and doing a lung transplant. When the surgeon removed the diseased lung, he held it up to his scientist friend and said, "This is the lung of a chain smoker. If he had carried on, he would have died in a few months. Now he is going to get a new lease of life. Is it worth going through this hassle of a major surgery? Is it not simpler to avoid smoking?" The scientist told me, "The sight of that black, horrible-looking, diseased lung was enough. I gave up smoking that very minute, and I have never smoked again." The point I am making is that these days, it is easier to focus the minds of people via the danger they face than being coy and avoid speaking about certain things just because they are unpleasant. Let me put it another way. These days, the staple diet for newspapers in India is corruption and rape culture, unless there is some sensational breaking news. All sorts of people are saying all sorts of things about these two terrible problems, and of course also recommending various remedies. Basically, they are variations of the same theme and boil down to stiff laws that would punish offenders severely. You know something? Decades ago, Swami said two things that are most pertinent to the two problems I just now mentioned. The first thing Swami said is, end of education must be character. I repeat, end of education must be character, which means that if a person is properly educated, that person must have character. Okay, that was the first thing. Swami then added, without individual character, there cannot be any national character. That is simple and also obvious. However, these days, the obvious is what is most easily missed. Just look around. Wherever you see, there has been a serious decline in individual character, which automatically means that character would be seriously compromised in the macro as well. My point is, stiff laws to punish offenders is not going to stop potential offenders. It is true that from time immemorial, the feeling has existed that draconian punishment is the only way to discipline. It is equally true that despite this widespread belief, crime and murder has not come down. What happens when entire communities go berserk? There is a very good example of all this from the world of medicine. When a person has advanced cancer, the only option available is major surgery, radiation therapy and chemotherapy, all of which are horribly unpleasant. But is there not a complementary aspect associated with prevention of cancer via disciplined life and being careful about what one eats, etc.? What I am saying is that passing draconian laws alone is not enough. Take crime. In olden times, crime was mostly meant theft, armed robbery and murder, most of which is committed by poor and uneducated people. I still remember back in the 40s, crime rate in India was quite low. Today, if you look at the crime scene, a lot of the high-value crime is committed by educated people. Just look at how corporations have duped investors and investment bankers have taken customers for huge rides. And by the way, let us not forget cyber criminals. What does all this show? It highlights the fact that there is something seriously lacking in education. More specifically, not one student is being told in strong terms, that knowledge is a gift of God and should not be misused, especially in a heartless and at times brutal manner. Is anyone bothering about this lacuna? Hardly, apart from occasional mouthing of shallow pieties. It is Swami alone who constantly spoke about making character development an integral part of education. Where India is concerned, it's a tragedy that these days the national motto, Satyameva Jayate, or Truth Alone Triumphs, hardly finds any mention in any school. And add to that the irony, the wheel in the Indian flag symbolizes Dharma. Is anybody in India in high places talking of Dharma? No. In fact, according to our intellectuals, Dharma is religion and religion is poisonous. My point is simple. When public consciousness is aroused and the right approach is indicated, there can be positive results. For example, the public campaign by socially conscious groups has brought about a significant reduction in smoking in the United States. Similarly, by focusing strong attention on pollution, trafficking of women and children, etc., there has been a substantial arousal of public consciousness, as a result of which governments are beginning to confront such abominable practices. My point is simply this. A weed must not only be pulled out completely, but also burnt to prevent it from coming. Human mind is very gullible, and the more the attractions created to seduce it, the greater are the chances of a large number of people going astray. In other words, without being negative all the time, it is important to call attention in a suitable and sensitive manner to the dangers of many unpleasant things that are happening, all the way from how young people are being misled and deflected to paths that are harmful, individually as well as collectively, to conflict, war, terrorism, destruction of ecosystem, and finally climate change. At the same time, in focusing attention on problems being faced by society, we should not get lost in merely cataloging problems. We must also make strenuous effort to point out the solution. Most of the media today is least concerned about solutions, and the reason is simple. Like any other commercial institution, the commercial media is largely concerned about ratings, the amount it pulls in as advertisement revenue, and so on, because it's all about surviving and making profit. Mercifully, we here in Radio Sai do not have to bother about pulling in ad revenue, top the ratings charts and so on. Thus it is that we are able to discuss basic solutions based on Swami's teachings. I think I have gone on long enough, and so let me summarize what I have said in this, the opening talk in the present series on Musings on Education and Learning. Basically, my focus is on Swami's teachings, what he told us, and the deeper significance of what he taught, not only via discourses, but indeed from the way he lived. I was driven to this topic not only because I was personally involved with awareness classes here in Prashanthi Nilayam for over a decade and a half, but also for another important reason. And that reason is that over the years I met many involved with Bal Vikas and EHV teaching, as well as those connected with running such programs. While I am happy that such non-formal as well as formal programs for inculcating values in schools was receiving attention not only in India but the world over, I was also a bit concerned that somehow most programs of these kinds seem to reduce Swami's teachings to basic commandments similar to what Moses laid out. I entirely agree that very young children cannot be loaded with heavy stuff like the Atma. That said, it is certainly possible to do several things. The first is to slowly expose the child to how each of us is a part of a big system that is in dynamic equilibrium. Clearly, this has to be done in stages. For example, in the beginning, the child must realize how it is strongly connected to its family. We must then quickly enlarge the child's view by bringing in the whole class, the other classes, the school, which means the community of all teachers, the various facilities such as the library, playground, and so on. Throughout this process of enlarging the circle of acquaintance, if I may call it that way, the concept of duty and responsibility must also be slowly ingrained. And that obviously goes hand in hand with discipline and the primal importance of duty. In other words, the child must get acclimatized to being comfortable with a widening horizon. Now, why do I mention this? Because Swami has said that none of us is truly independent. Like the individual links in a cycle chain, or better still, like the individual parts in a Rolex mechanical watch, all of us are connected. And this connection forms a hierarchy, even as the fingers, hand, arm and the body form a hierarchy. More specifically, Swami was particular that all of us are a part of human society as a whole, which is a part of nature, which is a tiny aspect of God. To put it differently, the entire educational program, be it formal and implemented via the classroom or informal in the sense of Bal Vikas, etc., must be such that the child, after a few years, realizes not only its place in a divinely ordained hierarchy, but also its duties and responsibilities towards all levels of the hierarchy. With effort, one could also help the child appreciate that God is present everywhere, including in every single body, indeed in everything from the atom to the cosmos. Actually, all this can be done in a very interesting and indeed an exciting manner. These days, there is hardly any mention of responsibility. That word seems to have been dumped decades ago. Instead, everyone is clamoring about rights. I have a right to do this, I have a right to do that, I am entitled to this, and so on. Now, if I remember correctly, Krishna told Arjuna, the only right you have is that of selfless service in the name of God. That is what Karma Yoga is, and Karma Yoga is so powerful that by itself it can lead to union with God. Yoga, Swami has told us, means achieving union with God. Yes, Bhakti Yoga is one such pathway that is exalted as also enchanting. Nevertheless, let us not forget that Swami laid great insistence on service. That, however, did not mean that Swami sidelined bhakti or devotion to God. Instead, he said, serve everyone, seeing God in all those whom you serve. Then your service gets upgraded to worship. This is how work gets converted into worship, Swami said. The fine print about seeing God in the one who is served is vitally important and is what adds icing to the cake, if I may put it that way. To use a modern analogy, it's like an airline passenger with plenty of frequent flyer miles getting bumped up from economy to business class. There are many other things Swami expects. However, these would have to be dealt with in later talks. Now, in this talk, I have merely scratched the surface. And the basic points I have made thus far are the following. 1. To begin with, I discussed learning, and how it is not only larger than formal education, but it also is something we do practically throughout our lives, perhaps unconsciously. Two, I then pointed out that while young babies learn at a voracious rate, grown-ups too can and do learn, though, barring exceptions, at a lower rate than babies. Three, I next drew attention to the important fact that while Krishna gave only one discourse, Swami delivered at least 1,000 and in diverse settings. Four, what is important is not the number of discourses that Swami gave, but how beautifully he unpackaged the message of the Gita and repackaged it so as to adapt it for this day and age, as also to diverse audiences. Five, that said, thanks to the prevailing ambience, created in no small measure by market forces to which media plays a willing second fiddle, most people have been conditioned so that they have little time or appetite for words of wisdom. Six, the net result is that swept by the prevailing ambience, even if it be unconsciously, people everywhere, devotees included, tend to have all sorts of misconceptions and end up missing the main purpose of why Swami came for us. This cataract that has covered our inner eye has made us blind to the fact that Swami's teachings actually can solve all problems humanity is facing. Some might regard this as an exaggerated claim. I would say not. And in support of my argument, I would like to draw attention to the bhajan, Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma. We all know what it means, don't we? Just focus on the one word Jnanam, which means wisdom, ultimate wisdom. Since Jnana is the same as God, Swami's teachings have the power of the divine. If we say we have full faith in Swami, then I would say we must have equal faith in the power of His teachings. Swami has often said that the mind is the son of the Atma. That should make clear that while the power of the mind is awesome, when it comes to brass tacks, its power is no match for the power of the Atma. In turn, it means that the problem humanity faces, all of which are caused by the mind and mind only, all these problems can be solved by tapping the power of the Atma. Sure, there are a lot of details that need to be spelt out, but that can be done once we have the faith that solutions do exist. It's time to wind up this talk. What would come in the next? Right now, I do not know. However, I would let Swami lead me when I get ready for the next. For now, let me just thank you for your patience and hope you got something of use from this talk. Please do write to us with your comments and feedback, which, as I said earlier, is very important for us. Offering this talk to Swami, I take your leave, and I hope to be with you again soon. Jai Sai Ram.
Tune in to Sai. Spend the day with Sai. From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sai's Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Rainbow. hopping clouds and sing along spring.
Sit down my hopping clouds and sing along spring.
Love all, love all, Sai Baba Jai.
Love all, love all, Sai Baba Jai.
Giving love and kindness is the way of life.
Giving love and kindness is the way of life.
Open up your heart, Sai Baba Jai.
Krishna Baba Avatar. Spend the day with Sai. From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sai's Thursday Live.
Radio Sai.